now, Godzilla!
Godzilla! You can pretend Godzilla turns a mighty castle into a pile of sand.
Go to it, Godzilla!
You control Godzilla's ugly tongue.
Hi, and welcome again to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me again is Jason.
Hello again, everyone.
And this is a unique one. This is the first time you and I have ever taped this quickly again, doing 2 in 1 month like this.
That's true. That's true.
For you, for everyone listening, the first part of our Halloween thing has not dropped, so we don't have your feedback. So we're flying a little blind.
As we're recording this, we have not posted the first Halloween episode.
Having said that, some of you have come up to the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/podstallions, for those who don't know, and mentioned things like, I hope you talk about this, and some of you have just nailed things we didn't talk about in the first part.
There's a combination of things we didn't talk about, and also, eerily, it happens a lot where they say, well, I hope you're going to talk about this, and you and I sort of already had it in the outline, you know.
Yeah.
We were going to talk about it, so that's cool too.
But there was a fellow named Brian who posted, well, I hope you guys talk about those Cracked Monster magazines. And I freaking loved those. I collect those. There's one on my nightstand right now, and I didn't mention it last week. Highly influential.
Wait a second now. We're talking about Cracked Magazine.
Cracked Magazine, 11 months of the year, was an inferior knockoff of Mad.
Right. Let's lay it out. We had Mad Magazine, the reigning champs and always champs, and all the stuff we love in Mad Magazine. Speaking of which, I was talking about this with a kid at a wedding reception a few weeks ago, and he was 10 years old, and he was into all this cool stuff that we were into that you'd think a kid of his age wouldn't be into, because it's not – I don't know how many kids know about Mad Magazine, but he loved Mad Magazine and Spy versus Spy in particular. He loved.
Well, Matt's got that television show.
Well, do you remember he mentioned that too. But do you remember the stuff that I loved the most in Mad Magazine were the strips that they had no dialogue, but they were done by Don
Martin?
Martin.
Yeah, beautiful.
The Don Martin stuff is so iconic, and so the only person that I can think that it's even close to reminding me of is Terry Gilliam and some of the insane stuff, his original animations. The way he designed stuff, it's so specific. It was so graphic. A lot of his stuff that it kind of spooked me as a kid. Some of the violence in it. But anyway, Mad Magazine were the champs. Then you had Cracked, which was if they didn't have Mad Magazine,
if they were sold out of Mad or it was
sold out of Mad,
yeah,
you were for Cracked. If they didn't have Cracked and you were really desperate for a joke, you'd pick up Crazy. Do you remember Crazy?
Yeah, I hated Crazy.
And I mean, Cracked had did Cracked have the janitor as the mascot?
Cracked had Sylvester the janitor.
Crazy had like a clown or something?
Obnoxio the clown.
Right.
I bought one issue of Crazy. One.
Yeah, you were really desperate. There was nothing on the shelves. There was no Starlog. There was no Fangoria, no Mad, no Cracked. If you picked up Crazy, you were desperate, or you were in the middle of a flu or something, and you had to have something to warm you up.
And the other thing about Cracked, though, was like Mad's a hard formula to imitate, but Cracked kind of had it 50-50. And there was one thing about Cracked Magazine I did like as a kid but didn't understand, was there was a character drawn by Bill Ward called Nanny Dickering. Do you remember her?
Boy, no.
Really?
I remember – I'll tell you what I remember about Cracked. The big signpost for me for Cracked was the Star Wars issue.
Oh, yeah.
There was a Star Wars issue with a wraparound cover, the inside cover wraparound. You'd take it out and you made it as a little mini poster, and it was all the creatures at the cantina, and then the janitor guy was standing in the middle of the room. They were all pointing at him and laughing like he was the creepiest looking dude in the bar.
I remember that one, yeah. You just, I haven't thought of that in years. But the thing that Crack did really well, well, first of all, I'll get back to Nanny Dickering. She was a cartoon character that looked like Russ Meyer drew her.
Okay.
And I didn't understand why I liked her as a kid. Now it's not such a big mystery. But Cracked would do this monster issue every – I think it was a special. And I think they may have done it once or twice a year, but they would take the they would have little stories and featurettes and a Nanny Dickering thing. But then there would be photos from monster movies with funny word balloon captions.
Oh, okay. Now I know what you're talking about. Okay.
And I just
– they did a book – didn't they do a book like that for Star Trek?
They probably did, but the monster ones just came around every year, and I bought them religiously, and I just found them to be like addictive as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I see them in the wild, I buy them. I have stacks of them here. I don't know what to do with them.
It's funny you say that though. Back to it's sort of similar. Were they in like paperback form?
No, they're magazines.
Oh, the magazines. Okay, so they didn't ever like compile them into a paperback thing, like Mad used to do when Mad would do the reprints and they'd put it in a paperback.
I totally had a lot of those as a kid.
We had a bunch of those.
I don't remember Cracked ever getting into that. Maybe they did. They must be rare.
My older brothers had them. They had my brother Jack was way into Edgar Rice Burroughs, and he's the brother that turned me on to John Carter of Mars and the Tarzan books and stuff. So he had all that stuff. And between he and my brother Gino, they used to get some of the Marvel, paperbacks where Marvel would take five or six issues and squish them into a paperback, much smaller. And then we had all the Mad books, like Mad and Son of Mad. And
my aunt had those.
Yeah, we had all those, and we had all the Peanuts ones too.
Me too.
They just seemed to be like sort of perennials. They were always kind of laying around different corners of the house were these paperbacks of all these things that we dug. And we had loads of the Peanuts books, like just dozens of them.
I had tons of the Family Circus.
Now that's probably a statement that I have never heard from anybody's lips.
I love Bill Keane's The Family Circus.
You don't hear that much. No. I think it's a perfectly fine little strip, but he always seems to get made fun of.
Yeah, well, there's that too. And
because it's just so tame. You know, it's cute and tame.
It's cutesy poo. The early ones are kind of funny.
That's very funny.
And I always love an early strip. I love the way the characters develop. You know, like Charlie Brown looked really weird at the start. And
I love the early, because they almost look like, you look at them now and they almost look like Muppet babies.
Yeah, they're so stylized.
So stylized, and it's almost like that was the intention, was to make them younger than they ended up looking, but it really was just the progression of the characters. But you look at those early Peanut strips, of their heads were much smaller than they ended up being.
Yeah.
You know, they had pupils, I think, a lot of the times. And they were just, I mean, like Linus was just cute as hell. Even Snoopy was just such a cute little dog. They changed drastically over the years. So the Cracked thing, yeah, we definitely missed that. The other thing that we missed that came to – well, maybe we should start this sort of chronologically.
All right.
Let's start with the holiday itself, Halloween. So we – a little history lesson for everyone, for those of you confused about what goes on in Canada. Well, okay, now aren't we getting close to, or did we just miss Canadian Thanksgiving?
Canadian Thanksgiving is it's the second weekend of October.
So it would have been this past weekend. No, it's this coming weekend.
Yeah, but we're not doing this chronologically. So it's we're taping on the 8th. It'll be this weekend. But
okay, right.
But by the time people hear this, long past.
My apologies. But the reason I bring it up is that it's something that I'm not sure a lot of folks, or at least folks in the U.S., you know, are aware of, that there is a Canadian Thanksgiving that's a completely different, date and everything. And people probably wonder about Halloween if it's just as big in Canada. So we've established that we're all celebrating Halloween at the same time, that you and I had these childhoods. So do you remember, can you recall what the first costume was and your first Halloween outing for candy? Do you remember what that might have been?
I believe I was a mouse.
Just a mouse.
I may have been 3, 2. I don't even know. Yeah. I don't believe I had a choice in the matter. And I think I have a photo of it, but your eyes will bleed from my wallpaper.
Wow. I'd love to see that. But isn't that interesting? Because again, you probably didn't have a choice because you probably weren't that keen and didn't really get what the whole thing was about. I think very, very vague memories here. There's no photographic evidence, but this is creepy. There were clown costumes that my two brothers must have worn on some Halloween, and I believe one of them got handed down to me for that first Halloween. I don't recall it. I just remember them being in the house after the fact, and somehow as a kid remembering how awful they were and thinking I'm never going to wear that again. So I think I actually had to wear a clown costume for my first outing. And again, generic. You know, you're talking about a generic mouse. I'm talking about a generic clown, although mine was the crying on the inside clown. I did decide that before I left the house.
You win.
Crying on the inside.
Actually, mine may have been a homemade mouse costume.
I was going for a red skeleton, you know.
Yes.
Look, that Halloween. That's how advanced I was.
A quick aside, I hung out with two guys all through high school that their mother was obsessed with clowns.
Really?
And in the house was a portrait of two clowns, and I never understood it. And then I was at a party at their house one day, and this girl pointed at them and went, "Oh my God, it's the guys as clowns." His mother had portraits done of them as clowns. And we turned to point it out to them, and they both just were like, "Screw off. We don't want to talk about it."
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's a direct-to-DVD horror film right there.
They were a little scarred. Yeah.
That's creepy. What was it? Emmett Kelly? Was that the guy? Was that the?
That's what they were. That's what they kind of looked like too in the portraits. Like
never understood that, how anybody was other than terrified, absolutely terrified of clowns. I don't know when they were funny or warm, or I still don't get that to this day. I know it's a cliche, but it's true. I always found them disturbing. So then we start to figure out what Halloween is, which means, you know, we're keyed up for the candy, but also we start taking a vested interest in what we're going to wear for Halloween. Now, last episode, I mentioned that I swear I picked out a Spock costume and went as Spock one year. And this had to be pre-Star Wars. For those of you out there that forget or are a little bit younger, there was a world before Star Wars, and it was dominated by Star Trek. I mean, it really was. We could do a whole show just on Star Trek, how remarkable that story is.
Oh, we're going to have to.
I don't think can ever be overemphasized just how remarkable this of a success story this thing was that nobody really cared about, that managed to only be off the air for a couple of years before it ends up being an animated series. You know, like even that, you think it's remarkable that the syndication was going so well by 73 that someone was confident enough to go ahead and make an animated series. I mean, think about that. That's, you know, all that weird stuff that was happening in the early 70s because of syndication and the cartoons that would happen and everything. And then the toys, how huge the toys were. So the Star Trek characters, the TV characters, were big Halloween costume characters. I'm guessing you probably have better knowledge than I do, but 74, 75, 76?
There's a couple, I think the Spock you would have had. I did a little research, and there's three Ben Cooper Spocks. One was actually done in the 60s, which is shocking, and is the most expensive one because it probably had a much more limited run.
That is shocking. I'm always shocked by any of the 60s merchandise that comes to that I find out about, because
I think Collegeville had it in the late 60s, and Collegeville was the also-ran company. And then Ben Cooper got it in the 70s, and I think they did two different versions of it. And then the movie came out, and they did another Spock.
I'm pretty sure there was a picture of Spock on the front.
You can bet your dollar there was. I think there's a picture of Spock on all of them.
On all of them? Okay. So I remember some yellows and some blues and some silvers.
The packaging is sublime too. Like, I had a boxed Klingon costume for a while, and the box art's awesome.
Well, do you remember how they used to, you know, they used to sort of give you an idea of the variety of characters that the company had? And so on the packaging, they would put like, you know, three or four faces.
Yeah.
And Spock was always one of the faces.
Yeah, he was, they had a Star Trek specific box, but yeah, then they would have this kind of like all the rest. And sadly, you know, I love Monster Squad, and I'll get into that later. They never got a Monster Squad specific box. I always just get a sticker pasted on the boxes or something like that.
Yeah, but yeah. You got Monster Squad Halloween costumes.
I do.
That's cool.
I wish I'd found them in 1976, but yeah, they'll do.
So it's funny because, you know, besides Spock and Vader, and I, you know, clearly must have gone from the time I was 5 to the time I was, you know, 9 or 10, I must have gone out for Halloween. Those are the only two costumes I seem to have recollection of. And the Vader one, I'm pretty sure I'd sent you a photo of. And I think it's up on Plaid Stallions.
Could be, yeah. I'm sure I went as Vader, but I can't find any evidence of it.
Well, it was the Vader mask, and then the chest, of course, was a picture of Vader, because yes. That was his weekend outfit that he wore a T-shirt of himself.
Yep.
And but you know, again,
it wasn't actually Darth Vader; it was Al Vader.
It was Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Before they fixed the spelling, you know, October 31st in the Twin Cities can be very, very cold for Halloween. So that was one of those examples where I had to wear a full snowsuit under the costume. And it ripped the crotch, that nylon crotch, you know, in the pants. Uh-huh. And it wasn't as menacing as I would have liked. Because I think it came with a cape, too. I think it came with a vinyl cape that you tied around the neck. So I remember that. So Halloween, and just as a little side note, many, many years later, when I grew up and started collecting toys again, as a grown-up, I found something that I didn't know existed, which was an Indiana Jones Halloween costume.
Yeah, I never saw that either.
And I picked it up, and I have in the box a Ben Cooper Indiana Jones costume, and it says on the side, Indiana Jones from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, good. I wouldn't have known.
Which is very cool. And it's also cool because it's like, you know, it looks like his outfit. Rather than a big picture of him on the chest, it's, you know, it's his outfit with the whip and the gun holster. You know, it does have the Indiana Jones logo or the Raiders logo on his belt or something.
Do you remember the Boba Fett? I went as Boba Fett.
Yes!
It's pretty much a drawing of the Kenner action figure on his chest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That mask is – the mask is almost kind of like
– see-through.
See-through. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a cool one. Yeah. And then I also found out many years later, I only have the mask. They made, I believe, 2, maybe 3 Halloween costumes for Flash Gordon, the 1980 film. Now, I have – the mask, the Flash Gordon mask. I do not have the costume, and I think the other one was a Hawkman, just a generic Hawkman. And I've been looking for them for years, never found them. But I did find not too long ago, I think I told you about this, on an Italian website, Italian toy site, I found a licensed Flash Gordon 1980 from the film Halloween costume. From Italy.
Was that a Halloween costume or was that a play suit?
It might have just been a play suit. Maybe that's what it's called. But it's the insides look nothing like Prince Baron's outfit. They're like the outfit's like brown and red, and he's got like a brown, you know, Robin Hood hat with a feather coming out of it. But it's got a big sticker on the side that says Baron.
Sure, it's not Flesh Gordon.
You know, and it lists the other characters, which I think were Ming and Dale. And Flash. So those are out there somewhere. And then the box has beautiful pre-production, advanced one-sheet artwork on the cover. So, but those are costumes that I've been looking for half my life. So if anybody can ever turn us on to those, please do. So, okay, so Halloween is a big deal. But, you know, I think you and I are in agreement, even as adults here, that the whole month should be embraced and celebrated with monster movies and candy and just all kinds of fun stuff. I mean, hell, I bought a Frankenstein doggy cookie yesterday for my dog.
Yeah, well,
I couldn't help it. It's Frankenstein.
But as it happens, I'm a monster toy collector. I'm sure I've mentioned that before.
Now, which one first, though? Was it Did you sort of eventually fall in love with the monster thing, or is it one of those things that you look back on because of the childhood thing, or?
Oh yeah, as a kid, I didn't have as many as I do now, and I didn't get everything. But you know, I've noticed that there's like a seasonality to it. It gets that you get more monster toys in the month of October than you do all year round, and I think that's why a lot of them tend to be kind of cheaper rack toys. Because they're thought of as seasonal. There's a few lines that were available year round, like Mego's Monsters and Remco's Mini Monsters and things like that. But I think retailers often think of, you know, Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman as mostly something you sell in fall.
Yeah, short shelf life.
And so I think I just always loved the stuff, and as an adult, it just, the other thing is it's a lot of undiscovered countries. You know, there's a lot of stuff I don't know if it exists or not, and it's hard to find, and I kind of like hunting stuff.
Yeah, so you're kind of the master of that with a lot of the rack toy stuff. I mean, monster stuff, but also the rack toy stuff, because as I've said, and you just said undiscovered country, it really, a lot of what you're looking for is uncharted territory. And you know, there aren't those handbooks out there you know, for all the rack toy stuff. So you're constantly finding stuff that you never knew existed, and that seems to be the same thing with the monster stuff. So let's go back to the childhoods and some of the stuff that you had as a kid that maybe you weren't collecting, but that was monster related that you were into.
The two things I really remember loving were the Lincoln Monsters, which were those. For those that don't know, they're 8-inch. Knockoffs of Mego and AHI type figurines of the monsters, and they did six characters: Frankenstein, Dracula, Mummy, the Wolfman, the Hunchback, and the Phantom of the Opera. And Hunchback and Phantom of the Opera, nobody else did in the '70s.
Mm-hmm.
And they also released a little figure as a catalog thing called the Victim. She came in a boxed set of four monsters. And it's basically, I think, a fashion doll from somewhere else, but they sold her as the Victim in 1974 or 75 in a Spiegel catalog.
And which, wasn't there something – sorry, go ahead.
What I was going to touch upon, I think you're going to talk about, is years previous, Aurora released a girl Victim model kit that got them in a lot of trouble.
That's exactly what I was going
to say. And for Spiegel to do this seemed almost dubious. I doubt anyone complained, but it's really strange, bad idea marketing, which I also love. But my dad sold the Lincoln Monsters because he took me along on a buying trip once, and I saw them, and I said, oh, I want that. And that's the rest is history. and I'm sure I've talked about that before, but the other monster line that I really loved were AHI. I didn't have a lot of AHI monster stuff as a kid. I missed it all, but I did have the wind up super monsters, which was like they had a Godzilla, a King Kong, and a creature, and you wound them up and their mouths sparked.
Were they little, like sort of little chubby?
Yeah. God, I loved those. I remember buying them at Canadian Tire, of all places.
See, I remember what was the line? Was it Lincoln that which one had the actual words on the packaging that said "Famous Monsters"? And it was kind of a ripoff of the Famous Monsters logo.
Yeah, that's Tomland.
So Tomland. So see, I always got these mixed up. There was Lincoln, there was Tomland, there was Mego, of course. There were the Kings that were out there, but it was all that 8-inch style, you know, 8-inch, you know, articulated figures with cloth outfits.
Mm.
And I, you know, I had some of that stuff, but it didn't stick around very long because I was so young, I think. But I mean, I remember having the, you know, the creature from the Morlock. From the Time Machine?
Yeah, Tomland did something differently. They saw everybody else did, you know, Dracula, Frankenstein, and they zigged with this official Famous Monsters, but I don't think that they paid a dime to anybody.
Right.
And none of these characters were Famous Monsters of Legend other than, like, the Yeti. They did the Fly. It was a really cool one. The Morlock. And the Yeti, and I'm missing a guy. Don't make me. I'll come to it. they did these characters. Oh, the Cyclops, which was the Cyclops from the seventh voyage of Sinbad.
Yeah, with the horn out of his head.
And then they just released all those characters in their space line, called them the Star Raiders as well.
That's right.
Tom Land was really like this company that just decided, hey, we're just going to copy what everyone else is doing. And they did their own version of the Bionic Man. They did the famous monsters. They did something called Creatures from Other Worlds, which was a Star Trek knockoff. And then they just melded all those characters together for Star Raiders. Then they brought out the Star Raiders as glowing characters. And then possibly some of the rarest action figures in the world are the second series Tom Land Famous Monsters of Legend, where they did Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, and the Mummy. And they're really weird-looking figures, but they were so limited in release that collectors pay thousands for loose figures.
Well, we should be ridiculous not to talk about this. Two things. First question is, who did Mr. Rock?
That was Lincoln International.
That was Lincoln. Okay, yeah. That was their Spock ripoff, which is brilliant. Before I die, I'd love to get the rest of them someday somehow, but I'd love to get a Mr. Rock because it's just so genius.
I'd love to get a carded one. I don't know if that'll happen, but
with his Barbie radio.
With his Barbie radio and his G.I. Joe flare gun that he can't hold.
Hair dryer.
Yeah.
But we've got to talk about you achieved something that no one's ever achieved. You have a complete set of the Lincoln monsters, correct?
Oh no, people have complete sets of the Lincoln monsters. And
not just a complete set, but you've got the special. Don't you have the special mail away version, like in a cardboard box with the victim? That
I've got one of those. Somebody did have. There was a tiny find of those, and there's a few of them kicking around, but not many. And then I'm kind of done with Lincoln. I got them carded. I got them in their little solid boxes, which were very, very tough to find. And I had to wait a few folks out. And,
we're talking those mailer boxes, those generic, right, cardboard boxes.
No, they released the figures in these almost like the early Migos didn't have a window in the box.
Yep.
And they've got this beautiful artwork. Well, it's beautiful. It's also kind
of
simple and childlike in the same.
And kitschy. But didn't you – you're talking store versions, but didn't you get the catalog version, like the Sears?
Yeah, I've got the Spiegel catalog set.
And that's the one in the generic box, right?
Yes, but that isn't as rare as some of those solid boxes are.
Oh, see, I thought that was the Holy Grail.
Well, you're talking like there may be five of those mailer boxes out there.
Yeah, that's still.
But there's only like two of some of these solid boxes. There's always hope that some will surface, but
yeah.
I think they were only released in England, and I don't think many people kept them. But you know, there's hope springs eternal. I hope there's a bigger find of these things. About 7 years ago, I bought a loose Lincoln mummy figure off a woman in England. Mm-hmm. And she just had the auction as mummy. And I bought it, and she sent it to me right away, and then she wrote me, and she goes, I followed your email address back to the Mego Museum, and you seem to know this stuff. And she sends me this picture, and she had two cases of them.
Wow.
So she was a single mom. She's a nice lady. I said, listen, I'm going to lay it all out on you, and I'm going to tell you exactly how to sell these things for the best profit. And she was, to her credit, she made good money. But yeah, she had a small find of them and some other stuff, and she made good money, and I think that's great. She needed it for something that was, real life issues those kind of things do happen. And for a while there, Lincoln monsters became kind of, they weren't too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But that dried up, and now they're back to being kind of hard to get and expensive. I
Way to go, Hyler.
Couldn't afford to collect them for a while. And then when I started collecting them, because I just made them my focus, I didn't do anything else, I saved my money. I just caught the tail end of her glut on the market and managed to pick up the first like three or four dirt cheap now. But at the time, they were really expensive. But anyway, they were my obsession for years. And when I finished the set actually around this time a year ago, and I haven't, you know, I love them. I'm glad I have them, but I'm also kind of like free at last, you know. And I don't have any real big collecting obsessions anymore, and I like it.
Did you hear the little werewolf in my house?
Yeah, what was that?
That was a werewolf. That was a 7 pound, 6.5 pound werewolf.
Ah.
I've been nursing back to health. Wanted to give his 2 cents on Halloween. The other things that we talked about Target last time and how I associate Target stores with Halloween and, you know, candy corn and monster movies and all that stuff. It all gets put into one big bucket, you know, one big plastic pumpkin shaped bucket for Halloween. One of the other things that was, I think they're still out there in CD form, but the thing that every year there seemed to be a new one, and I would get it, were the haunted house records. You know, the sounds of Halloween or the scary sounds or the haunted house. And some of them had sort of, you know, stories. Some of them were just sound effects records where you just had, you know, and they were incredibly loud and frightening. Like they just, the way they had certain sounds and screams, they really turned the volume up in the studio or something.
Somebody transferred one of those to, like, you could download it, a 70s one, and I put it on my iPod so I could use it at Halloween. And occasionally I'll be driving around somewhere and I'll just have it on a mix, and all of a sudden it'll just be werewolves.
You've got it on random, and all of a sudden a woman screaming.
Yeah.
On track 12.
And I have satellite radio, and they actually have like a haunted house channel. Now, and the kids want to listen to it all the time. Like, we'll be just driving in October and like, Dad, put Scream on.
Oh, that's funny. Well, it's funny because I go, there was a, this is a really strange thing too. I don't know if this was common in grade schools or not, but I remember there were these weird times in grade school that I always kind of go back to. There were the show and tell days. There was the one time in, like, I don't know if it was third grade or fourth grade. I had a girl, okay? I had a girlfriend in like second, third grade. Wendy Rausch, if you're out there listening, wonder whatever happened to you. She was the cutest girl. She was so cute. And she had like a little space between her front teeth, you know, like Lauren Hutton.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was like bring your, you know, you can bring your records to school day and you could bring in 45s. And I remember she brought in Pat Benatar. She brought in Hit Me With Your Best Shot. That was very cool. But anyway, one of the other things that for some reason the teacher said, let's do this, and we would do it, was a swap day. It was like a little shop that was set up, and each kid got a little section of, you know, around the room where they could bring their goods, and you could you'd bring your stuff and you could swap for stuff. It's such an odd thing, but I know this happened. I remember this because two of the things that I got, I don't remember what I swapped, what I would have brought of my own stuff to swap.
Yeah.
But two of the things I got, I think it was from the same kid. One was a black and white, I'd say 5x7 sort of postcard, you know, bigger than a postcard, but something like that. Black and white shot of King Kong holding Fay Wray. It's that real iconic shot, you know, where he's kind of walking through the city. He's kind of on the building, I think, or he's walking through the city or something. He's got her in one hand, and I got that. And the other thing was a Famous Monsters record, and the artwork on the cover was Bela Lugosi and Frankenstein.
Is that the one the Famous Monsters speak?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the one. Is the one.
I've seen that at a ton of shows. I've never owned it, though.
And I had that record. I had it as a kid, and I was just obsessed with it. Which leads me to this. You know, we were talking in the other episode about how the monster stuff just seemed to really kind of explode in the 60s and early 70s, especially, I think, maybe even more so, in all different avenues. You know, cartoons, movies, you know, serials, you name it. The monsters were kind of popular again. And one of the avenues that they went down was comic books. And Marvel, because that, you know, must have been something to do, just like the Star Trek stuff, when you think about how that merchandise got out there because of syndication. There must have been, you know, all those Saturday and Sunday, you know, running the horror movies in the afternoons or the Godzilla movies or whatever, you know. I think there's a reason that Godzilla became a cartoon and a toy in the late 70s. I think it has to do with running those movies all the time on local stations and getting, you know, ratings or whatever. Must have been the same thing for some of this monster stuff, because there was a very, you know, Hammer horror sort of version of Dracula that got his own comic book. And was it called The Tomb of Dracula? Was that what it was called?
I think so, yeah. I never really read those.
I read the Dracula one, and I know I shouldn't have. I probably was too young to be reading it, because it was very violent. But there was Dracula, there was a Frankenstein one, and there was one that was called Werewolf by Night.
I remember them. Yeah, I remember Werewolf by Night. And I think a few years ago, Toy Biz actually put out a figure set of all those characters.
They did. They did a box set of them, which is hit or miss. I've got the Frankenstein and the werewolf out of that set, and those are pretty cool. They're pretty accurate to the to the comic version. I always thought Werewolf by Night was the single dumbest name for a comic book or for anything, because
Werewolf by Noon.
Yeah, is there anything more self-explanatory? I mean, there's a full moon. He comes out at night. He's not going to be werewolf by brunch or, you know, by breakfast or something.
Didn't Marvel also do magazine versions of some of those? Like, I seem to remember that I was 13. I bought a really saucy, kind of sexy comic, that black and white magazine with a gray Morrow cover. Like Lilith, Daughter of Dracula, and I thought they did more of that kind of stuff too.
Probably, because yeah. They did it for Conan, they did it for Hulk, you know, they did those...
Doc Savage,
those oversized magazines, which reminds me, I still have the magazine version of the Doc Savage, the movie thing. I still have that for you.
Oh, cool. I loved that thing.
Yeah, I've got the magazine, the official magazine that came out. But anyway, that brings me to something else about famous monsters that I wanted to talk about I mentioned to you before, but first and foremost, the comic books then led to Power Records. You know, Power Records, those amazing book
They're
and record
brilliant.
Sets. Brilliant. That just, I think a lot of the artwork was, who did we decide did a lot of that stuff? Was it Infantino or?
I thought it was some, a lot of the, I thought.
Neil Adams or somebody, who did a lot of that stuff?
I don't know if we decided that. I think that they were done a lot by the bullpen. I think some of the Marvel stuff looks like John Buscema, but I know somebody that would know.
And well, again, for those of you out there that don't know what we're talking about, Power Records was a company that they did 12-inch, you know, records with like four stories, you know, two on each side. But the stuff that I remember the most fondly are the book and record sets. So it was a 45, and it was that typical, you know, when you hear the sound, you know, turn the page. But instead of just a book with pictures and
it
was a full comic book, fully acted out, not just narrated. And I got to tell you, some of this stuff scared the crap out of me, because again, like there was one with Spider-Man and the Moon Wolf. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember J. Jonah Jameson's son, right?
J. Jonah Jameson's son, and it is so scary and so loud and violent that I'd always have to turn the volume down. My little record player. I had the Captain America and the Falcon one. I had a lot of the Star Trek ones. Those were very unsettling too. The thing that's weird about the Star Trek ones.
The cat. Really, do you remember? Did you have the one with the cat?
Yes. The Mission to Moab. Or
yeah.
Something. They all start talking like cats. They're
yeah, talking. Yeah. That one was a little.
Now
different.
A lot of the stuff you can find on YouTube, and they also did. What I'm getting to is they did Power Records for Dracula, Werewolf, but I'm sure they did all those guys. And we're totally sidetracking here, but if you go to YouTube and look one of those Star Trek book and records up, you will be shocked how good the voices sound
and how white Uhura is, and
how white Uhura is,
and how black Mr. Sulu is.
The voices, you know, the guys that were doing Spock and McCoy and Kirk really kind of nail the voices. They're really good impressions of those guys, because it wasn't done by, you know, by the actors. But something else that I've always wondered about, and this is something that I think I've found in some old issues of Famous Monsters, or I eventually found online, that there were ads in the back of Famous Monsters for, you remember the character Vampirella?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think was that the character that was created by Forrest Ackerman? Or
he had a lot to do with it, yeah.
Okay, so there were ads in the back for a model kit.
Yep.
Okay, but there was also an action figure.
I don't think there ever was an action figure.
But I swear there's a picture of some kind of prototype in black and white in one of those issues, unless I'm totally crazy or I saw it online or something. And it was, you know, sent directly to the magazine to get this figure. It wasn't something that was like in stores. Now, I don't know if it ever got made. But I think there were at least plans for a Mego size figure of Vampirella
that maybe I don't remember.
They got into some trouble with the model kit, didn't they? Because she was so naked.
Well, she didn't help. No. The problem really was the whole misogynistic tone of the line. Basically, it had a girl. It was pretty not well thought out. You know, it had a girl victim, and then all these different ways you could torture her, which, you know,
well, you're talking about the victim.
The victim was part of that Vampirella wave, though.
Oh, I see. Okay, so there was that. Now, which were the ones, though? Was it Aurora that made the ones that I was fascinated with were the giant bugs? Was that Aurora that made?
No,
like
that was the I believe that was. I'm going to edit this out while I Google. The gigantic series, is that MPC?
No, that's MPC. I think you're right.
AMT.
AMT. Yeah. Those were always in a catalog. I think a little mini catalog would come with another model kit or something, and I would obsess over the pictures.
They're incredibly badass kits.
There was a giant praying mantis and then like a giant spider, I think. They were so freaking cool. You'd look at them and think, that's a movie. Why isn't somebody making the giant praying mantis into a movie or something?
It was a praying mantis, a scorpion, and a tarantula. And
yes!
they were re-released recently too. I remember thinking they were awesome. I bought one as a teenager and then realized, oh, I'm not going to put this together.
Yeah, where am I going to put this thing?
Yeah.
Those were very cool. The monster kits, of course, were big. But then something happens that's really cool, I think, is the Remco stuff in about, what was it, 70 – no, 80, was it? 79 or 80 almost?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the tail end. And I would consider that almost the last hurrah of monster merchandising for a while. Especially in our childhoods.
And generally when we talk about monster merchandising, aren't we sort of talking about, you know, the classic guys? We're talking about...
Yeah, you can like Freddy and Jason and Michael Myers all you want. I don't consider them monsters. And, you know, I don't refer to them as monsters.
No, neither. We're not talking about, you know, Hunchback here. We're talking Chaney, you know, Phantom of the Opera... Karloff, Frankenstein, Lugosi, Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, the werewolf or the wolfman,
yep.
You know, as I like to call him.
Now, it's one thing you just said, though, like Lugosi, Dracula was often not involved in any of this stuff because, like, if you look at the Remco monster line, Dracula kind of looks a little generic. In fact, the 9-inch doll, it's a picture of Count Yorga.
Well, didn't he make it onto the Remco stuff though? Wasn't his
no,
face?
No, his face is on the packaging, but the figure doesn't really look like him.
Okay.
And it's because, and I'm not sure of how they even pulled that off, because A made Dracula stuff that looked like Lugosi either. In fact, on the world famous Super Monsters, the original AHI packaging, it shows Dracula, the creature, the Wolfman, and the Mummy, and then for some reason, and I gotta think it was a legal issue of some kind, Dracula used to just come on his own Count Dracula card.
Mm.
And there was – it all boils down to one of the earliest crusaders for, hey, don't use his likeness, was Bela Lugosi Jr.
Yeah.
Who grew up to be a lawyer, and he was inferior, you know, upset at the idea that they were capitalizing on his father's likeness.
Who, by the way, and I don't know if we've even talked about this, there's a thing that's done here it used to be once a year. Now I think it's twice a year because it's so successful. Monsterpalooza.
Yeah.
It's done in Burbank at a hotel in Burbank. And it's really cool because all the monster stuff comes out, the merchandise tables, and then all the makeup artist guys do this amazing display of stuff. And the last time I went to one of those, Bela Lugosi Jr. was there behind a table, you know, for, I don't know, something to do with Lugosi, obviously. Have you ever seen him?
Yep.
It is insane how much he looks like Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, he's a much healthier looking Bela Lugosi.
Well, because Lugosi's dead.
But what I mean is that, you know, he's in good shape the last time I saw him.
He looked good, but it was, yeah. I couldn't look away. I'd never seen him before. I'd never seen him in person, that's for sure. And I thought it was just so eerie that he was so dead on. The likeness was creepy.
I've gone through this toy collector thing of kind of resenting him because he's, you know, you can't, you know, Sideshow had to negotiate separately to get Lugosi's likeness and all this stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's his dad, you know.
Yeah.
They're exploiting his dad's likeness. And I can't, you know, that's what's going to happen. You know,
it's funny because, you know how much I love the Beatles and they're sort of my religion and everything, but you know, the stick they used to get about when are they going to release the CDs? When are they going to put out, you know, when are they going to be on iTunes and what about this and what about that? And here we go again or whatever, you know, those guys, some of the deals that Brian Epstein did for those. And again, you know, you don't want to criticize him too much because there wasn't a lot of precedent to be set before a lot of what they did. There wasn't anything on that scale in so many ways. When you think about the money that they did make in the 60s, and of course, there's another horror story about how it all got tied up in the early 70s to the point of, you know, Lennon having to borrow money. I mean, it literally got tied up and they couldn't touch any of it until the lawsuits got, you know, settled. But when you think about what they did make, what they were able to do things with or buy houses with in the 60s, and they were millionaires, but it literally was a fraction of what they should have gotten. He signed a licensing deal, and you think about all that Beatles merchandise from bedspreads to Beatle wigs to action, you know, little Remco figures, you name it. They got 5%, 95% of that royalty went someplace else. He signed away 95% of their royalty rights. And they've been, you know, picking up the pieces ever since, trying to get what they're due. And finally, you know, got to a point where they bought up all the footage that exists of those guys so they can license it, because everybody else was making money off of their likenesses and their, you know, just their appearances, except for them. So I get it. I mean, it's you know, if everybody else out there is doing it and getting a piece, you know, I mean, if it gets to be ridiculous, I understand the other side of it too. But yeah, it's his dad, and it, you know, he's gonna, that image is gonna be around. It's what's interesting about a lot of this stuff we're talking about, these monsters and these designs and stuff, is how a lot of it was really in a very tight period of Hollywood, a very short burst in Hollywood in the 30s and early 40s, but yet we're still talking about it, how iconic the looks are of a lot of those creatures that, you know, it's perennial. Like I said, I bought a Frankenstein cookie for my dog yesterday.
I bought a big Frankenstein, Karloff Frankenstein poster for my window at Spirit the other day.
Yeah, there you go. Do you remember the one that was in the back of the comic books?
Yeah, that big 6 foot tall Frankenstein.
Was that the Bernie Wrightson one?
I think there was a Jack Davis one at one time.
Jack Davis, that was it. Yeah. It was Jack Davis.
It's beautiful.
Bernie Wrightson. Did you ever get the Bernie Wrightson monster book, the pop-up book?
No.
Oh, it's really cool. It's all his, you know, versions of these different monsters and stuff. And I met him at a show, and he signed it. I've got it somewhere. It's very cool. But his version of Frankenstein is a sight to behold.
Now, we were talking about the Remco monsters there.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were the last hurrah. And Remco, which is AHI, by the way, you know, AHI had bought the name Remco, so they were the same guys who did the world famous Super Monsters in the mid 70s, but they did a more kind of quality TV advertised look for the second run. They did a first. They started with 9-inch monsters, which were similar to Mego, and they made a playset for that, which was like a monsterizer. You put Frankenstein on that table, and it lit up.
Yeah.
And the heads glowed in the dark, and they were neat figures. But
those
I think
those were 9 inches tall. Those
yeah,
were?
They're just slightly taller than Mego's.
Okay.
Now
I remember. Okay. Yeah, the boxes were really strange. They had that flap sort of that
and
came out.
Beautiful artwork.
At an angle, the flap was sort of at an angle. Is that right?
No, they're just regular flaps.
Is it a regular flap? Okay, I remember those. And they had cloth outfits.
Yep. And they have weird bodies with this accordion thing that can crush things. It actually looks like they're hugging each other.
That's right. But and the monsterizer, what did it do? It was like a table that they were on, and those big straps sort of came over the body. But what did it do exactly?
It simulated
sex between the creatures.
Jiggity poke action monsterizer. It simulated, I guess, Frankenstein, the scene in Frankenstein where he's, you know, comes to life. But really what I think it was supposed to do, it made noise and it lit up and it glowed in the dark. It's almost like they went, well, it doesn't have a lot of play value, but collectors are really going to love putting one of these on their shelves because
yeah, what do we have them do? What would a playset for monsters do?
Well, yeah, and that's what I wanted to get to next was what I think is brilliant is that they then said they made a second line of monsters. They called them the mini monsters, and they're 3 3/4-inch Star Wars type figures.
Yeah,
and I absolutely love this line. I wish I could collect it all over again. And now I'm collecting them on Canadian cards because they're hard to find.
I had those suckers. I know I had Dracula, and I think I had the creature, and I think I had the Wolfman. The card art is brilliant too. It's that weird
bleak.
With just kind of a silhouetted. How would you describe that image?
It's like a black and white type image.
Yeah, but it's right from the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, those were really cool. And they came with a playset too.
Yeah, they had their own version of the Monsterizer. And then they had a playset which was like a spooky house that had a place for Frankenstein to lie, like a sarcophagus for the mummy to come out of. Like the thing that I really love about that toy is it's now envisioning that the monsters all hang out.
Yeah, of course they're outcasts. Of course they're going to hang out.
And I don't know what they'd all do with each other or if they'd like each other, but those are fantastic figures. And it's funny too. The Remco repurposed that set for their Sergeant Rock line. I think that same year, it's the same house, but instead of being a haunted house, it's now like a house in France with sandbags in front and. You know, it's a World War II battle scene.
It's probably the same house. It's just that 100 years later, the army guys got there.
Well, that's right. Yeah, it could be.
And cleaned it out. But they did hang out. The monsters hung out, as we know, because one of the great sad stories in your toy past probably is that Monster Squad, while it did get some toys, more than a lot of cult stuff that we like, that's for sure. Like. You know, I had to start my own toy company to finally get Flash Gordon toys, from the movie. They never made those things. But there were supposed to be action figures, right, made for Monster Squad?
Ideal got the license to Kids from Caper. Do you remember that show?
Oh, and just vaguely.
Yeah, that was another Burton D'Angelo production, which was the same company that did Monster Squad. And then Ideal licensed Monster Squad, and they were going to make three. They were like using the Evel Knievel bendy bodies, okay. And they were going to do Bruce and Frank and Dracula, and then do the Monster Squad van, which is really a cool van. I mean,
yeah.
And then the only thing that all got scrapped, but then the only thing that did come out is Ideal had a line of like. Little vehicles that rev motors that are called Mighty Mo's. And they did release a Mighty Mo of the Monster Squad van.
Wow. Do you have it?
I do. I don't have it carded. I tried to get it carded, but I didn't. And then, of course, there was another company called Garland, I think, not related to Jeff Garland, but Carlin. Maybe it's Carlin. Mm-hmm. They did a line called Chained Monsters, and it's a bendy of Dracula the Wolfman or Frankenstein, and they're meant to be worn as chains. Now, okay. The interesting thing about these bendies is they're all wearing the Monster Band radio belts from the Monster Squad.
Ah.
So I think this line was meant to be a licensed Monster Squad toy line.
Oh, it has to be. That's a dead giveaway.
But they, you know, the series got canceled or whatnot, and they just went ahead and released them as just generic monsters. You know, and
speaking of the show, you know that Dracula ended up being the voice of the Scarecrow on the Batman animated series.
Yeah, and sadly, you know, I just discovered he died last month.
Henry Pollack?
Henry Pollack, too, died last month.
Oh.
That means there's only one living cast member of Monster Squad. Oh, sorry. Sorry, Fred Grandy. Two living cast members. Of
Jeez,
Monster
the guy
Squad.
Only made it, you know, to Washington.
Yeah, sorry.
Come on. Well, that's funny because one of the bits of merchandise that did exist that I never got, but I was obsessed with, because I was big into, you know, we talked about the whole comedy aspect of the monster stuff and how much I loved Young Frankenstein. I think we all kind of loved that movie.
Yeah.
But I kind of had the same feeling for Love at First Bite when that came out. I had the photo novel, and I think I must have seen it in the theater at least three times. My dad loved it. We just – like me and my dad and my brothers would go see this thing and just – we just got the biggest kick out of it. So I was on a bit of a Dracula kick because of this. But there was also that Frank Langella movie that came out that was supposed to be, you know, more hardcore that, you know, I couldn't get into. But on the back of Famous Monsters magazine, I think it was the back inside cover or the very back cover – for a long time, they advertised this necklace, and the charm on the end of the necklace was a little glass coffin, and inside the coffin was some dirt, and the dirt allegedly in the ad
from Romania, right?
Came from Romania directly from Dracula's grave.
Yeah,
I thought, wow, that is like
right next to my real piece of the real cross.
Yeah, or a little. They used to cut up the towels that the Beatles used at hotels. They would cut them up and sell like a little, you know, 2-inch by 2-inch piece of cloth on a card because the Beatles might have used these towels. So I always wanted that necklace, that coffin necklace. Fast forward a bit here, if we could, to present day, just a little bit. Two things. One fun thing that happened monster wise that I thought was very cool. That really made me think of my childhood was when The Nightmare Before Christmas came out, the Tim Burton movie. I just fell in love with that thing, and I saw it a bunch of times. And, you know, Hasbro had the license for toys. And very much like you were talking about earlier, you know, the seasonal aspect of, you know, monster and Halloween stuff.
Yeah, they didn't seem to know what to do with it.
They didn't know what to do with it, but they made some beautiful stuff. They made a set of action figures. They made larger figures. They made a large, you know, Jack that talked, you know, larger plush figures and stuff. And then once it got that netherworld between Halloween and Christmas, they discounted everything.
Yeah.
You know, you could get the figures for like $2 a piece kind of thing.
But there were people running around collecting those then.
Yeah, and I was one of them because many years later, you know, being out here in L.A. when I decided to finally sell everything, that was a time when it was just before the Japanese market and manufacturers really latched on to Nightmare Before Christmas in like the late 90s and started making more like June Planning and companies like that started making lots more new merchandise. But right before that, there was nothing. And so suddenly this Hasbro stuff just skyrocketed. So I sold it all at a time, you know, when there was nothing else out there. And the film was taking on this cult status. And I did very, very well with it. And then, of course, all the Japanese stuff started to happen. And then the Hasbro stuff started to go down in price. And then years later, NECA, I think, re-released all those figures just as they were back in 93. But it's a stop motion film. Everybody knows it now because it's ironic that it's the 20th anniversary this month, and like El Capitan is doing a huge celebration and 20th anniversary and all that. Disney just dumped this movie when it came out, and just there was no merchandise, you know, nobody cared about it, and now they redressed the Haunted Mansion, you know, in Jack Skellington stuff, and there's loads of merchandise at the parks and everything, but nobody cared about it when it came out. But it's a great movie. It holds up very well, I think.
I had to paint Zero on my daughter's wall a couple of years ago, so I'd say it's held up quite well.
Well, there you go. And it's very much done by people who clearly love the stuff that we grew up with and the Rankin Bass stuff. But by the same note, there's two things that have come out recently in a similar vein, because we talked about the Rankin Bass stuff, the stop motion stuff, recently that I cannot recommend enough. One is called Paranorman. Did you ever see this one?
No, the kids, I skirted that one.
It's great. It's just wonderful. It's stop motion, and the kid, you know, sees dead people in the town and stuff. And I'll leave it there, but it's very clever, and there's, you know, really funny gags in it, and it's very cute. But even better is Frankenweenie, the new stop motion, black and white stop motion film that originally was a live action short that Tim Burton directed back in '84. They've made into a 90 minute feature. And it's just great. It's got, you know, like so many in jokes, so many great little callbacks to the Universal stuff. And one of the coolest things in it, his science teacher in the grade school looks just like Vincent Price.
Cool.
And he's voiced by Martin Landau. So Martin Landau's doing this, you know, crazy German, you know, Scrooge McDuck accent. On this, it's clearly Vincent Price in this thing, which again goes back to Burton's, one of his first things, the stop motion short he did called Vincent.
Vincent, yeah.
One of Vincent Price. So it's got all those elements of his stuff and lots of really cool callbacks to the Universal monsters in just the, I don't want to give too much away, but there's even a couple of kids in school. There's one that's kind of looks and talks like Igor. There's another kid that sort of talks like Karloff, you know, and he's voiced by Martin Short. It's very funny and very cool. It reminds me very much of our childhoods and the stuff that we dug back then.
Speaking of childhoods, you know, we've talked a lot about the licensed stuff, like the, you know, the Frankenstein, the Dracula, the Universal stuff. But there was a lot of cool monstery concepts out there that we really haven't, that were part of our lives, that really don't have, that were kind of unique to the 70s. And I think the most iconic of all of them is Hugo, Man of a Thousand Faces.
Oh, talk
like,
about
first of all, creepiest doll ever.
He's creepy without the Thousand Faces.
Now, do you know who created him?
I don't know who created him, but I know that wasn't that the one that Pee Wee Herman used to bring on stage with him?
And apparently Uncle Floyd did too. Yeah, I think with Pee Wee Herman it was like a hypnotist puppet.
Oh, right, okay.
Uncle Floyd, I don't know what he did with him, but yeah, Hugo's fame surpassed his life as a toy. I think it was Kenner released him in 75. I remember. I think the concept was kind of highbrow for kids,
mm-hmm.
but it was, you know, this puppet you could do makeup on, and it was basically a take on kind of Lon Chaney, Man of a Thousand Faces. And that was created by a guy by the name of Alan Ormsby.
And okay.
Ormsby directed a film in the 70s called Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Wait a second. No. Hang on. Hey, hold on a second. I thought Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things was directed by Bob Clark.
All right.
Because Bob Clark ended up doing Christmas Story. He ended up doing Porky's. Actually, he ended up doing a great Sherlock Holmes meets Jack the Ripper thing called...
You're right. I'm sorry. You know what? You're right. Ormsby did the makeup effects in Children Shouldn't Play with Dead.
Okay, all right.
And he acted in the film.
Okay, got it.
And he wrote a book called Movie Monsters and a scholastic book.
Okay.
Movie Monsters was this kind of monster makeup, what monster makeup and monster shows to put on. So it was like a kind of, you know, hey kids, you can be Jack Pierce book.
Let's put on the show right here.
And I remember that book as a kid, but moreover, and this is a strange moment in my life, is my wife was pregnant with our first child. Mm-hmm. She encountered complications and was rushed to the hospital. Mm. I was taken out of the room and told to go wait in the waiting room, and I was super stressed out. This is about 2002.
Okay.
And what's in that waiting room but a copy of Movie Monsters?
What?
And it's like an old friend that was there. Like, I don't know why it was there.
But it was there to comfort you.
It was like it was there to comfort me, or this hospital really needed to get some new reading material. But I just remember being excited to see it. And for a minute, it took me off my worry, you know. Ormsby is a very prolific guy, and that was a beautiful toy, Hugo, like the concept. And I wish somebody would kind of try and bring it back.
So strange. It's such an odd thing.
But
you know, it's funny you're talking about the book about, you know, monster makeup and putting on a show sort of thing. That's another thing that we haven't talked about, but what I thought seemed to be in every other magazine that I would get as a kid. Because as everyone, if you haven't figured it out by now, magazines were our internet back then. That's how you found out about everything.
Again, I'd like to point out that the average listener probably remembers dial-up phones, sir.
I'm hoping, so we don't sound like a couple of fogies. But this seemed to be in all the magazines in the 70s too. I think it had to do with Star Wars. And, you know, people forget, like, you know, that was a big, big movie for creatures and monsters. You know?
I think interest in horror makeup kind of just came out of the famous monsters and kids wanting to experiment with themselves. I mean,
yeah, there was. I think that's where it started. But
you talk to a lot of guys, and they especially filmmakers of this, you know, like later years, they all started making their own horror films on 16mm cameras. You know.
Yeah, but I mean, Star Wars had, you know, there were a lot of creatures in that canteen.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
And suddenly you started seeing ads for rubber, all those Don Post, you know, masks, the big rubber ones that were expensive and everything. And then there started to be these makeup kits that seemed to pop up in the 70s that were, you know, make yourself into the gorilla, you know, like a Planet of the Apes type gorilla, make yourself into the Phantom. You know, there was one that was like an alien, like a space alien of some kind.
There was a few by space aliens. I think the Pressman released a whole series of those called the Space Creatures. Or
always wanted to get one of those and never... Yeah. Never could convince my mom, I don't think.
Did you know they made one for The Incredible Melting Man?
Yes, it's in the back of Famous Monsters. And they made a Halloween costume.
Yeah, I've never seen that costume, but it's in the catalog, yeah.
Which is so bizarre. It's so strange to me. But then again, you know, there is a Blu-ray. I can't, this blows my mind, the amount of stuff that has taken 30 years to hit. You know, like Thundar the Barbarian. I used to love that animated series.
And it finally
got a DVD release a couple years ago through Warner Brothers. The Flash Gordon series, it took 25 years for it to finally make it to DVD. And right now there is a Blu-ray special edition, you know, mega edition set of the movie Life Force.
Well, I can give you two reasons as to why.
Well, yes, I can too. But it's still a crap film. I mean, it's Toby Hooper, I guess, is one of the reasons, besides Matilda May or whatever her name was.
It's
an awful movie, but it's like they're, you know, there's documentaries on it on this DVD and, you know, sit down interviews with everybody. And I don't get it, but
I must admit it's been in my Netflix instant recently watched an awful lot.
I did. It's funny. It was on, I forget what cable channel it was on like a month ago. And of course it's on. And, you know, my wife is like on the internet or something. And then of course she looks up at, of course, all the wrong times. She's like, what are you watching?
Naked Lady Show.
And I'm like, it's about space vampire. Like even
yeah.
The beginning is kind of atmospheric because they're going into this giant ship and it takes forever, but there's like these weird bat people in there and then all of a sudden there's naked people and then a naked woman. And she's like, what are you watching? And then I had to shut it off because I knew what was coming. She's naked throughout the whole, you know, walking around London, for God's sake. It's so strange. It's such a strange piece of movie making that was certainly one of those those rentals, a VHS rental that we would get over and over and over. Did I ever tell you this story? But can I tell you my howling story to try to kind of wrap the show up a little bit?
Sure.
Did I? Because we should wrap it up, right? Are we?
I had about 3 or 4 more points.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You do your points, and then I'll tell my.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't we close with your howling story? Because I bet I'll enjoy that. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Mattel's push with monster items in the late 70s, and some of the things. Now we all know about that they took Godzilla and Rodan and put them in the Shogun Warriors, which was brilliant.
Awesome.
And I was designed.
Rodan's quite pricey these days. Godzilla's pricey, but Rodan is a king's ransom these days.
I got one in the box off a woman for a while, and I put it in my office, and then I realized it's the size of a small bar refrigerator in its box.
Oh, it's big. You know, I have to notice, you seem to get a lot of toys off of women. Off of helpless women, it seems.
The ladies, they like me.
They like giving you toys.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I pay for these things.
No, I mean, you know, selling you toys, of course.
Well, you know, I not only collect toys, I collect friends. I said that so insincerely, it is actually kind of true. But, I had to actually part with that, and I parted with it to a good friend who really wanted it, so that worked out. But then they came out with a couple of original concepts, like... And this is the one that sticks in my mind because they had comic book ads for it, and I don't think it got released in Canada, which was Grigori, the vampire bat. Do you remember this thing? It had blood in its stomach. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember, but I remember the stomach was kind of see-through or something?
Yeah, well, they did a really good comic book campaign for it.
Maybe that's it. Maybe I remember from ads that I've gotten in recent you know, old books that I picked up.
I have never seen one at toy shows or anything. I've seen them online, but like I think if I saw it at a toy show, I'd probably go home with it.
How could you not with that name, Grigori?
I finally got that pun too.
You know, the thing is, the great thing about that is, so much of the stuff these days, there's probably like 72 people in a room coming up with jokes on a television script or coming up with names for things. Grigori was probably like 3 guys.
Yep.
In the design department. And they just batted that around for a couple of days. And that was it. They stuck with it. No focus groups. No, let's see how this plays in Peoria. Just, you know, Grigori. Let's see if it works.
They did that. And it was kind of a take on Pulsar. You know, the same kind of technology with Pulsar's blood and heart.
Oh, yeah.
But then they also came out with something that seemed to be kind of in the Stretch Armstrong family, which was Crusher.
I don't remember Crusher.
Crusher was this kind of big lizard you could crush down, and then he would pop up again.
Okay.
I never had one, but he's got a very iconic box. I think he had a TV commercial at the time. I can see the popularity, and a lot of people... when I did my top 10 70s monster toy thing on the site a couple of years ago, we're kind of miffed I didn't mention Crusher.
I don't remember that.
Neither do I, but there he is in all my old catalogs, and, you know, he definitely existed. And I sure as heck see him at toy shows. I guess because, unlike a lot of the Stretch Armstrong characters, Crusher's more durable, so you see him around in the aftermarket a little bit. You know, unlike the next character I would like to talk about, which is Stretch Monster.
Stretch Monster, that's a rarity.
Well, all the Stretch figures are a rarity.
But isn't that the one? Wait, I'm sorry.
I'm sure they made a bajillion of them.
I'm thinking of isn't the snake the one that's the
Stretch Serpent is
Stretch Serpent.
Yeah, that was real tail end stuff. Like
that was like they only made like 4 of them, right?
No. They probably made he was in Sears catalogs and that sort of thing. They probably made a good number of them, a good production run. These things burst. They split.
That was it. And they were toxic, right?
No, it was full of corn syrup. You'll be
fine. They were toxic. They killed kids.
No.
They killed Mikey.
I'm alive.
It killed Mikey.
I nibbled on my Stretch Armstrong.
They made the cereal. They killed him.
No, he died in Vietnam when he mixed Pop Rocks and Coke.
Well, and wait a minute now. I thought he was eating bubble yum, the first batch that was made of spider's eggs.
No, I think that you're thinking of the time when they pumped his stomach and they found a gallon of.
That was Rod Stewart. Everybody knows that.
Right.
He and Richard Gere We're at a rave in Hollywood.
Right.
And the next thing you know, he's getting his stomach pumped.
Yeah. Jerry Mathers was involved somehow.
So he was the doctor.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. On call that night.
And Lee Marvin fought alongside Captain Kangaroo in World War II.
Yes. You know, Lee Marvin got his ass shot off. He literally got like a chunk of his ass.
I don't know if you're being sincere or no. Like, I think we've been reveling in bullshit so long, I don't know what's real.
It's a true story. You know, there was a great Lee Marvin story. There was a documentary done. I'm holding my dog right now because he's desperate to get outside.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm holding him. There was a documentary done about Lee Marvin, and John Borman, the director, was a good buddy of his and did this documentary on him. And it's this great bit where they're out on a boat, and he loved to go marlin fishing.
Yep.
Lee Marvin, and he said, "You want me to tell you the secret to life? You want me to tell you my theory, the secret to life?" And he tells this story about how he was out fishing for marlin, and they hooked a marlin. He hooked a marlin. And this was going on forever, like for hours, you know, struggling with this marlin in the ocean. And I don't know if they had to change lines or you change poles or what eventually happened, but eventually the pole pulls back and they lose the fish. They lose the marlin. And when they reel the line in, you can see on the end of the hook is the marlin's eyeball.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, I know. It's brutal. But the gist of it was Marvin was like, that marlin had to make a decision. You know, either I'm going to be taken, you're going to get me on the boat, or I'm going to swim off missing an eye. And he struggled and got away and chose to fight another day missing an eye.
Yeah.
He was, ironically, he was hit in a school crossing the next day, the marlin. He was on his way to
right.
work and got hit by a bus. But, you know, he had a good 24 hours with one eye after that.
He made the most of it.
So can I tell my howling story now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot more we could talk about, but, you know, there's other episodes where we can talk about Aurora model kits and yeah. Mego stuff. And that doesn't have to be the Halloween. And we've crammed a lot of show into this.
Yeah.
So let's end with your howling story.
We're going into OT here.
That's a movie I'd like to actually revisit.
I think you're going to be surprised when you revisit it because it's not what you remember. But speaking of nudity in the movies and yes. lady nudity, The Howling came out.
That's my favorite nudity, by the way.
The Howling came out in 1980. So
yes.
I'm about 9 or 10 years old, depending on when the movie came out. My cousin David is like 3 years older than me, 2 or 3 years older. And he was always that kid that, because he, you know, also being older and also being kind of shady, he was always... You know, he was the kid that when he was 12 had like 2 VCRs, you know, and he had the dirty mags under the, you know, between the mattresses kind of thing and whatever. So he was the kid who was always like, you know, ironically, I could get him to do stuff or take dares that I would never do. But he was also that kind of devil on your shoulder that said, hey, let's go do this or whatever. So I'm at the movies with him, his mother, my aunt, Carmela, and our grandmother. We're going to see, I think it was called Inchon.
Oh, you know, my God, yeah.
I think it was Inchon. One of those World War II, I don't know what it was. This was like a 4-hour movie. There was an intermission, okay? So there's an intermission, and we decide to sneak out of there at the intermission to go to the bathroom, but also to sneak into The Howling. Now, I knew this was about werewolves. That's all I knew about it. We had never seen it. It's in the theater. We can't get into it, see a movie like this, you know? We come in, we get in the theater, we sit in the back. Now, my heart is racing already because I'm thinking if we get caught in here, we're going to go to jail or like this is a federal offense. You know, sneaking into a movie, like but you paid for the other movie. You can't just do that. And it's rated R. We can't just be here, you know. So I'm already freaked out. We sit down and it's literally about 45 seconds just before the campfire scene between the guy and the woman. And, you know, I had seen, you know, episodes of Monty Python where there were some boobies here and there and cartoon boobies, and I'd certainly seen stuff in a magazine. But to actually see someone, you know, in a movie, like, moving, you know, walking and being nude or whatever, like that, you know. And, like, the second we sat down almost, her entire kit comes off right there at the campsite, and then, you know, stuff starts to happen. Well, and she's full frontal, by the way, in this movie. So I was just like, it was kind of traumatic because it was like, oh my God, she's totally naked. And I remember my cousin even going, like, oh God, we better get out of here kind of thing. And we sat and we finished the scene, of course, and then we snuck out of there. But that was my first experience with full frontal female nudity in a movie. It was sneaking into The Howling at the exact point that her clothes come off.
That's good timing, sir.
Yeah, it was perfect timing. Yeah, and then I saw it many years later, you compare it. It's hard not to compare it to American Werewolf in London because they were like a year apart. Werewolves, obviously, the transformation and The Howling. The transformations take about 27 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, they spent so much time on the effects and you know, the pneumatics and everything else. It just goes on forever.
I can kind of remember that. I gotta rewatch it. I mean, it has been over 20 years, so I gotta give it a check.
Yeah, I saw it a few years back, and I was kind of surprised at just how, I was surprised by how satirical it was.
I remember that. Anyways, this is the perfect month to rewatch it. It just never seems to come up on TV around here.
No, it's because of that nude scene, I'm telling you.
Well, I see a lot of nudity on TV. I don't know if it's that. But
it's very traumatic nude scene.
I'm in very free-thinking Canada.
I tell you. So there's my Howling story.
That's very cool. I do not have a similar story.
No, and I'm
sad.
Once we got back into the theater to watch the rest of Inchon, I couldn't have told you what it was about. I have no idea what happened in that movie because all I was thinking of
was naked people.
The scene we just saw in The Howling.
You were a man that day, sir.
Yes, I crossed over. I had my bar mitzvah in The Howling.
I think for me it was Logan's Run was on in the French channel. The French channel was always good if you were really bored. You could watch a French episode of Space 1999 or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Logan's Run was on. It was called L'Âge de Crystal.
Bonjour.
And French, it was Canada. Rules are a little more lax, especially mm-hmm. Quebec. Quebec is very lax in their television broadcasting standards. And, I was watching the scene with Box, you know, and the ice thing. And what? You know, they didn't cut the nudity.
Wow.
And I was maybe, you know, 9.
So, Jenny.
Jenny Agutter. Not a bad way to start.
Well, she went even further in Walkabout.
Never seen it.
Yeah, she goes. But Logan's Run was a tricky one because it was – I never understood why they – didn't they – was there any reason for them to get naked in the ice, in the snow, like
no.
to change clothes? Did they really have to do that or put on those –
lots of opportunities for gratuitous nudity. That wasn't one of them. I never quite got it.
I think Box was a perv.
Box.
You know, I used to drink with him all the time at Timmy Nolan's.
So you've said, actually. Yeah.
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 He was quite a character, but...
He's a good presence to a film.
And he also was the narrator on the vinyl...
Star Wars record.
Story of Star Wars, yeah. It was his voice, yeah. So there you go. There's our tail end to our Halloween adventure.
Monster toys. There'll probably be lots of more monster toy talk throughout different podcasts, but we tried to concentrate as much as we could into one burst. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you have
never a bad time to talk about monsters.
No, and I hope you have a great and happy Halloween, guys.
Yeah, happy
guys
Halloween.
And ladies. Sorry.
Yeah, spread the candy out. Don't eat it all in one night.
Yeah.
All right, thanks,
Save
everybody.
Me some. Thank you.